Good morning, everyone. I see Patrick has the slide projector there all ready to use a nice PowerPoint presentation, but you won't be getting that from me. That's not my era. I'm in the era of the printed word. So you have a little handout today. I hope your prescription for corrective lenses is current if you need one, because the print is kind of small in there, especially when it comes to the texts from other sources. But I thought it would be very interesting to have those, and rather than have a handout that was 15 pages long, we went to a 9-point type. Well, maybe we could begin this morning with just a little glory be as a prayer. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and will be, world without end. Amen. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. So the subject of this class is to be the encyclical Caritas in Veritate, published by our Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, on the Feast of Saints Peter and Paul in 2009. Now, as Patrick mentioned, this is a class in two parts, which means it's a total of 6 hours. So that's generous for an encyclical. So the subject of this course is going to be not just that encyclical, but really the social teaching of the church in general. So we'll look at that encyclical, certainly, but look at it in context. So the Holy Father entitled this encyclical Caritas in Veritate, which means charity or love in truth. You can't really tell by the title what the encyclical is about, actually. Think about that. Love in truth. Now, that could be about evangelization. That could be about sexual ethics. That could be about almost anything. But it is, of course, in fact, about social questions. So this is not the first time that a Holy Father has addressed the church and the world on the subject of social questions. To appreciate what the Pope says in this encyclical, it is helpful to look at the whole tradition of the Church's social teaching. And not just as a general context, but also because the Holy Father quotes liberally from all of the documents we're going to talk about this morning when he writes the current encyclical. The very wide consensus, you know, it's hard to get historians to agree about anything, but there is a very, very wide consensus that the social teaching of the church began with a document called Rerum Novarum, of New Things, an encyclical of Pope Leo XIII, published in 1891. The publication of Rerum Novarum was certainly the beginning of the modern effort to apply moral principles to contemporary social conditions. But that first work, that really seminal work of Pope Leo XIII, did not arise in a vacuum. So we're going to talk about even the social teaching of the church before Leo XIII. And in order to talk about the social teaching of the church, we have to talk about the condition of the world, the history of the world. You know, in some of our Catholic theology, the matter about which we're speaking doesn't really change. For instance, if you're talking about the Holy Trinity, well, there's been development in the Church's understanding of the Holy Trinity as, over time, questions arise, the Church lives the faith, there's greater penetration into ways to speak about the mystery of the Holy Trinity, but nothing new ever really happens in the Holy Trinity. That's not the case with the social teaching of the church, of course. As you'd expect, this is teaching about society, and society changes. And so the social teaching of the church, as we would expect, evolves to address current questions. So prior to 1891, the world in which the church spoke about social questions was a pre-industrial world. In the pre-industrial world, the world before the Industrial Revolution, wealth tended to be static. Wealth was based on the possession of land. If you were a landed person, if you had land estates, you were rich. If you didn't, you were poor, at least marginally poor. Wealth grew very slowly, and most individuals tended to remain near the level of wealth into which they were born. If you were born rich, you could very confidently be assured that you would die rich. If you were born poor, it was in all likelihood going to be the fact that you died poor. The presumption of the church was that a few would be rich and many would be poor. And her social teaching largely consisted in insisting that those who had more were obliged to have concern for those who had less. This social teaching of the church was rooted in Revelation even prior to the coming of the Lord, in the heritage of the Old Testament. In the heritage of Israel, there was a strong tradition of concern for justice in all levels of society, because, of course, the Israelites were a visible community of people, and it was very important that everyone understood how disputes were addressed, what was fair, what you could expect for what kind of injury. That was a great benefit to the Israelites in maintaining peace in their nation. So there was a great concern for justice in Israel and also for the protection of the poor. And this is reflected in the Old Testament, in the law, the prophets, and the writings, the three great types of literature that we find in the Old Testament. That's actually perhaps the Jewish way to speak about the Old Testament, the law, the prophets, and the writings. The law, you know, refers to the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch, or the books of Moses, as they're called. The prophets are, of course, those who did God's will and delivered a word that was addressed by him to the children of Israel. And the writings were those timeless, inspired books that spoke about how one was to live, about wisdom. So sometimes in our Christian approach to the Old Testament, we talk about historical, prophetic, and wisdom books. But the Jewish people talk about the law, the writings, and the prophets. So I give just in your notes there the citations that I'm going to cite, because these are readily available in any Bible. From the law, we have this famous passage from the book of Exodus: "You shall not molest or oppress an alien, for you were once aliens yourselves in the land of Egypt. You shall not wrong any widow or orphan. If ever you wrong them and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry." Of course, this was a protection of the weak. The widows and orphans had no warrior to defend them, to defend their rights, and so they were easy to pick on. So the law was eager to defend those who were weak as a matter of justice. "My wrath will flare up, and I will kill you with the sword. Then your own wives will be widows, and your children orphans. And then there were particular protections for the poor in that same passage from the book of Exodus. If you lend money to one of your poor neighbors among my people, you shall not act like an extortioner toward him by demanding interest from him. If you take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, you shall return it to him before sunset. For this cloak of his is the only covering he has for his body. What else has he to sleep in? If he cries out to me, I will hear him, for I am compassionate. So that from the law, and then from the writings, that little passage from the book of Proverbs, injure not the poor because they are poor, nor crush the needy at the gate, for the Lord will defend their cause and will plunder the lives of those who plunder them. So do no injury to the poor. Do not crush the needy at the gate. The gate was where justice was administered. And then perhaps most famously from the prophet Amos. Amos is the great prophet of social concerns, the great prophet of justice in the Old Testament. And the passage I have cited there is this. Hear this, you who trample upon the needy and destroy the poor of the land. When will the new moon be over, you ask, that we may sell our grain, and the Sabbath, that we may display our wheat? We will diminish the ephah and add to the shekel and fix our scales for cheating. We will buy the lowly man for silver and the poor man for a pair of sandals. Even the refuse of the wheat we will sell. The Lord has sworn by the pride of Jacob, never will I forget a thing they have done. So, the point is, this was social teaching. This was the social teaching of the Old Testament. It presumes a static world in which they're rich and poor. The social teaching of the Old Testament was in favor of the poor for their protection. The original social teaching of the New Testament, of the church, is found in the Gospels. Those two passages that I cite there from the Gospels are characteristic. Others could be added to them, of course. The first one from St. Luke is the story of the rich man and Lazarus. There was a rich man who dressed in purple garments and fine linen and dined sumptuously every day, and lying at his door was a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who would gladly have eaten his fill of the scraps that fell from the rich man's table. So that is, of course, an interesting parable that the Lord tells, because the rich man is not accused of any direct injustice toward Lazarus. There's no indication that the rich man stole what should have been Lazarus's property. There was no indication that the rich man was deliberately unkind to Lazarus. He only ignored him. And so the concern that those who have more attend to the needs of those who have less, this is certainly a part of the Gospels. And then, of course, the famous scene of the Last Judgment from near the end of St. Matthew's Gospel, where the Lord separates the sheep from the goats. He will place the sheep on his right, the goats on his left. The king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. And so on. So, the judgment itself described in terms of caring for those who are in need. So that was the basis of the social teaching of the gospel. The concern and for those who have less, and an active initiative to do charity. Skip ahead to the Middle Ages. St. Thomas Aquinas lived in the 13th century. You probably know the name St. Thomas Aquinas. He was the most comprehensive theologian of the Middle Ages. He treated the most issues in the most systematic way. St. Thomas didn't dedicate a great deal of his work to social questions, that's for sure. But he did treat some questions that would subsequently be very important in the social teaching of the church, notably in his treatment of private property. this became a standard pillar of the church's teaching. And I give you there almost a whole question from the Summa of St. Thomas Aquinas. Because we have 6 hours. In all honesty. But no, you know, I'm sure that everyone has heard the name of Thomas Aquinas. I imagine that almost everyone has heard of his Summa Theologiae or Summa Theologica. But perhaps it's not so common to have actually looked at the Summa and to see, you know, what does it look like? How is it put together? So I thought, you know, that would be an interesting little aspect of the class today to see, well, what does this really look like in the raw text? So that's what we're going to spend a few minutes doing. So this is from St. Thomas's most famous work and longest work, the Summa Theologiae, the Summa of Theology, or the Summary of Theology. The Summa is divided into three parts, or four parts, depending on how you count. There's the first part, prima pars. There's the third part, tertia pars. But then the second part has two parts. The secunda has a prima and a secunda, a first and a second within it. So there's pars prima, prima secundae, the first of the second, secunda secundae, the second of the second, and then tertia. So this comes from secunda secundae, the second of the second, the second part of the second part, second half of the second part. Each part, or part of, half of part, is divided into questions, and each question is divided into articles. And every article is organized in the same way. In response to the question, the first thing that St. Thomas does is to offer citations from authorities. Authorities are always very important, that seem to give the answer with which he does not agree. So it's a kind of anticipation of any possible problem. He wants to get all of the contrary opinions out there and put them on the table, not hide from them, but address them straight on. So the first thing that he gives you is what are called the objections. What are the incorrect answers that you might think were right because of what you find in some authority? Then St. Thomas quotes another authority that supports his true answer. This is called the sed contra, because it always begins, but on the contrary, and then the citation of the authority that supports St. Thomas's position. Following that is what's called, usually, the corpus, or the body of the article, in which St. Thomas really lays out his position in his own terms. You know, prior in the sed contra, he has cited the authority that supports him, but in the corpus, he lays out what he wants to say in his own words. And then finally, after the corpus, he responds to each objection. He shows how he certainly appreciates the authority that was cited in those first objections, but how what that authority said can be understood in a way that doesn't contradict his answer. So he does that for every single question. They're all organized in the same way. So it doesn't always make for light reading. But it's very intellectually honest and very comprehensive. So sometimes the best way to read a question from the Summa is to start with the question and the corpus, St. Thomas's final answer. That sort of focuses us better, perhaps. And so this one on private property is really very interesting, I hope. I guess you'll be the judge of that. But the question, this question 66 from the Secunda Secundae is, whether it is lawful for a man to possess a thing as his own. So we would use the language of private property. Whether private property is lawful, whether it's permissible. The corpus always begins with the Latin words, respondio dicens, I respond saying. So this English translation makes that, I answer that. But that's the respondeo, or the corpus of the article. I answer that two things are competent to man in respect of exterior things. One is the power to procure and dispense them, and in this regard, it is lawful for man to possess property. Moreover, this is necessary to human life for three reasons. Listen to these reasons that St. Thomas gives. First, because every man is more careful to procure what is for himself alone than that which is common to many or to all. Since each one would shirk the labor and leave to another that which concerns the community, as happens where there is a great number of servants. That's something that we perhaps don't have direct experience of. But, you know, if something is everyone's job, it doesn't really get done. Secondly, because human affairs are conducted in more orderly fashion, if each man is charged with taking care of some particular thing himself, whereas there would be confusion if everyone had to look after any one thing indeterminately. It's almost the same point, except it's not sort of laziness, but it's actually confusion about, well, what has been done, what needs to be done, what hasn't been done in 2 weeks, etc. Thirdly, because a more peaceful state is ensured to man if each one is contented with his own. Hence, it is to be observed that quarrels arise more frequently when there is no division of things possessed. Maybe those of you who are parents will have noticed this, that if the toys belong to everyone, then it's not clear who can play with what toy when he or she wants to. But if this toy belongs to Susie, then that's Susie's prerogative. If she is playing with it, well, then, Jenny, you can't play with it right now. The second thing that is competent to man with regard to external things is their use. On this respect, man ought to possess external things, not as his own, but in common, so that, to wit, he is ready to communicate them to others in need. Hence, the apostle, that's always St. Paul, says, charge the rich of this world to give easily, to communicate to others, etc. So this is the old Catholic principle that the goods of this world were given to the whole human race. So that if someone is starving, for instance, that person has a right to food. Because before there was any division of property, God gave the world to the whole human race for its sustenance. So with regard to use, St. Thomas said, everyone has a right to use what they have a serious need for. So I think that's quite interesting in that it shows great wisdom about human realities. You know, if that first point of St. Thomas, that people are not so quick to do what is for the common good if they have no direct interest for themselves. If the world had remembered that, we could have saved ourselves a lot of trouble since the Russian Revolution in 1917. So sometimes, you know, people talk about St. Thomas Aquinas and the medievals as if they were always thinking about how many angels could dance on the head of a pin or something like that. But that is not at all true. It's very, St. Thomas is very practical, very concrete, very wise. So I gave you the whole question there apart from the reply to the second and third objections, because by that point you kind of got the point, I thought. But if we go back to the first objection, you will see Thomas says, and this is always the way he began the objections, it would seem, videtur in Latin. So that was the position that was not his. It would seem unlawful for a man to possess a thing as his own. For whatever is contrary to the natural law is unlawful. Now, according to the natural law, all things are common property, and the possession of property is contrary to this community of goods. Therefore, it is unlawful for any man to appropriate any external thing to himself. Then at the end of the article, as you have it there, he answers that objection. Community of goods is ascribed to the natural law, not that the natural law dictates that all things should be possessed in common, that nothing should be possessed as one's own, but because the division of possessions is not according to the natural law, but rather arose from human agreement, which belongs to positive law, as stated above. That's another previous question. Hence, the ownership of possessions is not contrary to the natural law, but in addition thereto, devised by human reason. So, in St. Thomas's treatment of law, there are different kinds of law. There is the natural law that God put into creation in the very way that it was made. There's divine positive law, commandments that God gave on his own initiative that nature itself doesn't teach us, but are commanded by God. Then there's also human law, human positive law, which doesn't have to be that way, but is that way for the sake of the common good. There's also ecclesiastical law, which is not coming from Christ himself, but is made by the church for the good order of the church, as divine positive law is made for the good order of society. So that's a little flavor of what St. Thomas Aquinas really looks like. To get back to the main channel of our class today, that's an example from the Middle Ages of social teaching, the social teaching of the church, that private property is just, that it is moral, it is right for a person to own property. The next pre-modern source that we will look at, and the last one, is the Roman Catechism, which was the Catechism of the Council of Trent. The Council of Trent was in the 16th century. As you probably remember, it was a response to the Protestant Reformation, especially to clarify, explain, and defend the teachings of the church against the objections of Luther and Calvin and others. So now, well, of course, we have the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which was published in the 80s. That is, well, it's the Catechism of the Catholic Church, but it could also be called the Catechism of the Second Vatican Council, because it was the new catechism made in the wake of Vatican II. The Roman Catechism was the Catechism of the Council of Trent, made to put the teachings of the council in a form that they were very accessible, not actually to the faithful, because, you know, books were scarce and very expensive, and not everyone was literate, for sure. The Roman Catechism was really written for the clergy, and so its form is that of instruction to pastors, really. It's what the pastor should preach to put the teaching of the Council of Trent into effect and to bring it to his people. So the Roman Catechism, unlike the Catechism of the Catholic Church that we now have, had no section on social ethics, but its treatment of the commandments touched some offenses and obligations that were relevant to social questions. For example, in its treatment of the seventh commandment, thou shalt not steal, we find this. And I have you have some passages there. Among those whom the Holy Fathers pronounce guilty of robbery, so of course the most clear way to be guilty of robbery is to take something out of the house of your neighbor when he is gone to the blacksmith shop or something. But the Holy Fathers also called this robbery. Those who in times of scarcity hoard up their corn, thus culpably rendering supplies scarce and dearer, more expensive. My grandmother used to say that, dear for expensive. This holds good with regard to all necessities of life and sustenance. These are they against whom Solomon utters this execration: he that hideth up corn shall be cursed among the people. Such persons the pastor should warn of their guilt and should reprove with more than ordinary freedom. Feel very free to flog the dickens out of those who would do this. What do we call this in modern terminology when there's a scarcity of something and you... gouging, right? Gouging, I think we call it. He should explain to them at length the punishments which await such sins. So again, this was directed to pastors. But this is a form of theft, according to the Roman Catechism, to gouge. And then also, of course, on the positive side, the old theme from the Gospels comes back, as one would hope. This commandment, and this is still under the Catechism's treatment of the seventh commandment, thou shalt not steal. This commandment also implies an obligation to sympathize with the poor and the needy, and to relieve their difficulties and distresses by our means and good offices. Concerning this subject, which cannot be insisted on too often or too strongly, you cannot say this too often, or you cannot emphasize this too strongly. It's impossible to make a mistake that you could say this too much to your people. The pastor will find abundant matter to enrich his discourses in the works of St. Cyprian, St. John Chrysostom, St. Gregory Nazianzen, and other eminent writers on alms deeds. So, not a systematic treatment of social questions, but those are social issues that are treated as a part of the interpretation of the commandments. There is one more, this word that might be interesting to add, about the social teaching of the church prior to the industrial age. There was the special question of slavery. As you probably know, slavery was common in the ancient world, and thus it was sort of presumed in sacred scripture. And St. Paul has instructions about how slaves and masters are to relate to one another. But under the influence of the faith, slavery disappeared from Europe before too long. In the age of exploration, I hope you remember this from fifth grade history. I think that's when we got it. Well, what was it first? The first guy was, uh, I think, Prince Henry the Navigator. Do you remember that name? He was Portuguese. And so he started just going out from Portugal in a ship. The first thing you get to are some islands off the coast of Africa. Of course, they knew of North Africa because that had been part of the Roman Empire, and that had been taken by the Muslims. But that was part of the known world, but that was sort of, off limits. It was well defended. It had its own civilization, its own armies to defend it. But then in the Age of Exploration, they found some islands off the coast of Africa, the Canary Islands, and they worked their way down the Atlantic coast of Africa to the Cape of Good Hope, and then around India, and then across Columbus, of course, across to the New World. So in the Age of Exploration, and with growing frequency from the 16th to the 19th centuries, racial slavery resurfaced as a major moral issue. It had died out in Europe under the influence of the faith, but then when people started encountering new parts of the human race and people of different races, then slavery rears its ugly head once more. On January 13, 1435, Pope Eugene IV issued a bull entitled Sicut Dudum. He sent it to a bishop located on the island of Lanzarote, one of the Canary Islands. So the Canary Islands are just to the west of Africa in the Atlantic, and very far north. So that's the first thing you would come to if you wanted to start exploring the world from Europe, and they started going out. The very first thing that the Europeans would have come to was the Canary Islands. So they get there, what's the first thing they do is they start to enslave people. But from the very beginning, 1435, the ores aren't dry yet, practically. Before Pope Eugene issues this bull with a condemnation of slavery, he says that after being converted to the faith or being promised baptism, many of the inhabitants of the Canaries were taken from their homes and enslaved. And he unequivocally condemns that practice. And there were many subsequent papal condemnations of slavery and the slave trade. So that's a special question, of course. It's its own little issue. But that was certainly an instance of the social teaching of the church before Rerum Novarum. So certainly before 1891, there was social teaching of the church. Although it's true that it began in a systematic way with that famous encyclical. And we'll be at that encyclical shortly. Now we're getting there slow but steady. All right. So if we want to talk about the modern social teaching of the church, the question is, well, why does that arise in 1891? We've done without it for almost 19 centuries. Why suddenly does Pope Leo XIII decide we should talk about these things? Well, it was not so much the inspiration of the Pope that suddenly I think I'll talk about something new that none of my predecessors has talked about. He talked about it because the world changed. The world had changed at the time that he wrote that encyclical in 1891. The historically static social and economic situation changes in the 19th century. That static situation that I described before. The rich are rich, the poor are poor. If you have land, you're rich. If your family has always had land, they always will have land. Then you will always be rich. And your obligation is to look out for those who are poor. But that changes in the 19th century with the coming of the Industrial Revolution, the creation of factories that produce manufactured goods in great quantity and at an affordable price. This had a tremendous effect, largely for the good, on the way that people lived. Of course, it brought a more convenient, comfortable, humane life within the grasp of ordinary people. So it was a tremendous benefit to the world, the Industrial Revolution. It's usually counted as beginning about 1760. By 1830, it was well established in the West, Europe, and America. So from this time of the Industrial Revolution, in the first place, persons became more mobile. In the olden days, not only could you count on staying in the same level of wealth into which you were born, but you more or less stayed put in the place that you were born. You were either tied to the land your family owned, or you were tied to the owners of the land in a particular place, and you had an acquired right, an inherited right, to be a tenant on that land and had a certain relationship with them. From the time of the Industrial Revolution, persons became more mobile because they went to the cities where the new factories were located. And of course, the new growing urban population often lived in extreme poverty. So that was a shadow side of the Industrial Revolution. Relationships between the rich, who owned the factories, and the poor, laborers, became depersonalized and functional. You know, I'm sure we mustn't romanticize feudal times. I'm sure it was not pleasant to be a serf, and it wasn't like you had a chummy relationship with the lord of the manor. But there was a certain sense in which the lord and his tenants knew one another. You know, they were your people if you were the landowner. And not only were they your people, but their grandparents had been the people of your grandparents. And so there was a sense in which there was a relationship. There was a real relationship of some kind between the rich and the poor. This was not true when people flocked into the new urban areas and they were employed by a factory owner who had no knowledge whatsoever of who they were and employed hundreds, I don't know if there would have been thousands in those early days, but a sort of great number of people. Wealth could be multiplied quickly, unlike in the old system, the old rural agrarian system. Wealth could be multiplied very quickly. And although it did create social mobility, the poor could become rich. Of course, in this country, we had great stories about that. Andrew Carnegie, of course, was a penniless Scottish immigrant who built U.S. Steel, and he, you know, became one of the richest men in the world from having absolutely nothing. That could not have happened in the Middle Ages. That just was entirely impossible. So the Industrial Revolution brought social mobility, but it also opened a huge gap between the super rich and the working poor. It was possible to acquire fortunes that, people acquire fortunes today too in some computer-related things. But this was a new phenomenon for sure. So the Industrial Revolution brought great benefits to the world, but also there was great poverty. In these new urban areas, there was a depersonalized relationship between the owners and the workers, and the gap between them became enormous. And so it was noticed that this was a problem, that there were certainly advantages, but not without difficulties that many people understood needed to be addressed. And this literary response, I just threw this in as sort of an illustration of the larger picture. I think most of us, all of us, know the name Charles Dickens, a great British novelist. So a lot of his works showed an interest in social reform. The Adventures of Oliver Twist, you know, the children in the workhouse with the bowl, you know, for their poor porridge. May I have some more, sir? That was 1839. A Christmas Carol, you know, that was a sort of a story of the wealthy miser being reconnected to an awareness of the humanity of his employee, Bob Cratchit. So A Christmas Carol was 1843. So these were novels of the Industrial Revolution. And they were a response to these problems that the Industrial Revolution brought. And of course, Dickens was British. And it was perhaps more, it was more prominently a problem and more energetically addressed in England than here in the United States. Our country was somewhat slower to industrialize than England. And also, of course, in the mid-19th century, when Dickens was writing, our country was really preoccupied with the slavery question, with North and South and, you know, intractable problem and would lead eventually to the American Civil War. But Dickens represents a literary response to these problems of the Industrial Revolution. There were other responses, and of course the name most associated with the philosophical response to the Industrial Revolution was Karl Marx, who along with Friedrich Engels wrote the Communist Manifesto in 1848, so an exact contemporary of Dickens. The Communist Manifesto included a series of short-term demands, including the abolition of property in land and the right of inheritance. So Marx said there should be no ownership of land and there should be no inheritance of wealth. He was willing to tolerate people having something so long as it was earned in their own generation. A centralization of the means of communication and transport in the hands of the state. So, you know, railroads were hugely, they were sort of the computer companies of the 19th century. You know, money was pouring into the building of railroads, and they made people, when they were successful, they made people fantastically rich. And there was also a big bubble in railroads, too, just like, you know, whatever is old is new again. The extension of factories and instruments of production owned by the state. So state ownership was a great favorite of Marx. Equal liability of all to labor, that there should not be these people who live on the revenues of their estates. And the establishment of industrial armies, especially for agriculture. So those were the short-term demands of Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto. And Marx believed that if those policies were implemented, they would lead eventually to a stateless and classless society. So all these problems of this huge gap between the rich and the poor, which just exacerbated that distance that had always existed from time immemorial, that would be done away with by eventually the abolition of all private property. So there would be no social class, and eventually there would be no state. The Communist Manifesto concludes with these stirring words. In short, the communists everywhere support every revolutionary movement against the existing social and political order of things. The communists disdain to conceal their views and aims. They openly declare that their ends can be attained only by the forcible overthrow of all existing social conditions. So the use of force is not excluded. Let the ruling classes tremble at a communist revolution. The proletarians have nothing to lose but their chains. They have a world to win. Workers of the world, unite. The closing words of the Communist Manifesto, also on display in the streets of Madison. So that was the Communist Manifesto. And then, that was a, as you can tell by those last words, that was a bit of a popular appeal. And then Marx's great philosophical work, Das Kapital, was published in three volumes, 1867, 85, and 94, the last two after his death. But according to Marx's theory there, the central driving force of capitalism is the exploitation and alienation of labor. The ultimate source of capitalist profits and surplus is the unpaid labor of wage laborers. So that there was a fundamental injustice in this system, and the root of it was private property itself. So now we're ready to talk about the first great social encyclical, Rerum Novarum. And I think we'll do that after a break. Maybe I should ask just if there are any questions thus far. Yes?
You just mentioned the Roman Catechism, and you said that it was written for the clergy, but that it was against Luther and Calvin's teachings on private property. Is that what I...
No. Thanks for that. Thanks for that question. The Council of Trent was called because of all of the disputes at the time of the Reformation, and so it was the Council of Trent was intended to put forth, explain, and defend the Catholic faith, especially in the areas in which it was being attacked by Luther, Calvin, and others. The Roman Catechism was the tool written to bring the fruits of the Council of Trent to the clergy for preaching purposes. It wasn't, this question was not especially one that was at issue in the Reformation. That's what questions are for, to clarify those things that might be misleading.
What do you think about agriculture? Did you talk about all that industrial, but you threw in
Oh, I probably referred to the world before the Industrial Revolution as an agrarian society. That, of course, there was still a lot of agriculture after the Industrial Revolution, but before the Industrial Revolution, that was almost all there was. I mean, of course, there were craftsmen who were making things by hand, one by one, very slowly, so which made them very expensive. But the essential economy was agriculture. All right, very good. So all of that explains why there was what we call now a social encyclical for the first time in 1891. It's because the world had changed, and the traditional teaching of the church about material things, wealth and poverty, and what does stealing mean, and private property, those things that had been settled questions for many centuries, those are newly in the news. Those are newly hot topics of dispute in the 19th century. So Pope Leo XIII in 1891 publishes this encyclical, Rerum Novarum. You know, Roman documents, including encyclicals, always have a Latin title that is just the first word, two, three words of the text. So the first words of this encyclical were Rerum Novarum, of new things. But they also often have a title in the modern languages which is not just the first words, but gives you a more descriptive idea of what the content of the encyclical really is. So the Latin title of this encyclical is Rerum Novarum. Its title in the modern languages is On Capital and Labor. So Das Kapital was Karl Marx. On Capital and Labor was Pope Leo XIII. It was a pretty direct response. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the dates, Das Kapital in three volumes, this encyclical comes between the second and the third volume. So it was a contemporary response and direct response to Karl Marx. In this encyclical, I've just picked out a number of particular passages here to illustrate a few points. First, there was the recognition of the problem. So Dickens recognized the problem, Marx recognized the problem, the Pope recognized the problem. In any case, we clearly see, and on this there is general agreement, that some opportune remedy must be found quickly for the misery and wretchedness pressing so unjustly on the majority of the working class. For the ancient working men's guilds were abolished in the last century. So there were guilds, you know, when there were just individual craftsmen making whatever they made. They tended to have associations called guilds. These guilds had a charitable purpose. They had religious function. You know, they would endow chapels. They would pray for the souls of their departed members and so on. But those have gone the way of all flesh. And no other protective organization took their place. Public institutions and the laws set aside the ancient religion. So the French Revolution has happened. The place that the church had in society where even kings could be brought to heel a little bit by their bishops or the Pope, who said, you know, you're acting against justice here. You'll be excommunicated if you do that, and so on. So in the new world, in the new industrial age, the place of the church, the ability of the church to condemn and correct abuses had been set aside. Hence, by degrees, it has come to pass that working men have been surrendered, isolated, and helpless to the hard-heartedness of employers and the greed of unchecked competition. So, this is what we have seen as the shadow side of the Industrial Revolution. So the Pope says, yes, there is a problem, but we do not accept the solution of Karl Marx. To remedy these wrongs, the socialists, working on the poor man's envy of the rich, are striving to do away with private property and contend that individual possessions should become the common property of all, to be administered by the state or by municipal bodies. So that's the solution of Marx. The Pope knows that's wrong because Thomas Aquinas reminded him of that already in the 13th century. It is surely undeniable that when a man engages in remunerative labor, the impelling reason and motive of his work is to obtain property, and thereafter to hold it as his very own. Socialists, therefore, by endeavoring to transfer the possession of individuals to the community at large, strike at the interests of every wage earner, since they would deprive him of the liberty of disposing of his wages and thereby of all hope and possibility of increasing his resources and of bettering his condition in life. What is the Pope saying there? That the socialists say, well, to do justice for working people, we must take away all private property. But the reason that people work is to accumulate property. And so in taking that away from those who have saved and acquired and taken prudent care of themselves and their family and their descendants, to take that away is exactly doing an injustice to those who work industriously. So based on tradition, based on reason, the Pope rejects the approach of the socialists. Then he reaffirms the right to private property. What is of far greater moment, however, is the fact that the remedy they propose is manifestly against justice, for every man has by nature the right to possess property as his own. This is one of the chief points of distinction between man and the animal creation, for the brute has no power of self-direction. Man alone among the animal creation is endowed with reason. It must be within his right to possess things not merely for temporary and momentary use, as other living things do, but to have and to hold them in stable and permanent possession. He must have not only things that perish in the use, but also which, though they have been reduced into use, continue for further use in after time. So it's another argument from reason in favor of private property, that animals only use what they need at the moment, and there's no thought of the future, because that is not within the competence of animals to think about the future. It's only the human person, as a rational animal, that knows about the future and can make provision for the future. And the effort to acquire property is a part of that exercise of our faculties that make us more like God, the intellect and the will that he has given us. By the way, when I was a kid, they told us that the squirrel who's burying those nuts that he picks up remembers where all those nuts are. So this seems to be contrary to the Pope's assertion. But I've since learned that, in fact, those squirrels have absolutely no memory of where those nuts are. They kind of hope that if they bury enough of them, they'll stumble on one or another later and not starve to death. So Pope Leo is vindicated in his understanding of the animal kingdom. So this is one thing, the right to private property. However, of course, the Holy Father is not arguing in favor of the rapaciousness, is that what he said? Hard-heartedness and unchecked greed of those who see themselves as just exploiting the work of laborers. So this next part, mutuality, is not a word that the Holy Father himself uses, I don't think. But he has to use the word mutual, and mutuality is a great word for the spirit that's expressed here in paragraph 19. The great mistake in regard to the matter now under consideration is to take up with the notion that class is naturally hostile to class, and that the wealthy and the working men are intended by nature to live in mutual conflict. That was, of course, Marx, this class struggle. So irrational and so false is this view that the direct contrary is the truth. Not only is that not exactly true, it's the opposite of the truth, the Pope says. Just as the symmetry of the human frame is the result of the suitable arrangement of the different parts of the body, so in a state is it ordained by nature that these two classes should dwell in harmony and agreement so as to maintain the balance of the body politic. Each needs the other. Capital cannot do without labor, nor labor without capital. Mutual agreement results in the beauty of good order. The first principle of heaven is order. while perpetual conflict necessarily produces confusion and savage barbarity. Now, in preventing such strife as this and in uprooting it, the efficacy of Christian institutions is marvelous and manifold. It is especially the gospel, the faith, that can ward off this conflict that might be to which the different classes in society might be tempted. First of all, there is no intermediary more powerful than religion, whereof the church is the interpreter and guardian, in drawing the rich and the working class together by reminding each of its duty to the other, and especially the obligations of justice. So the Pope is in favor of justice. He's in favor of mutuality. Interdependence is another more modern word. Charity among the different parts of society, which are not meant to be in conflict, but which are necessary to each other. And of course, this is as old as the teaching of St. Paul. You know, the eye cannot say to the hand, I forget which body parts the apostle specifically invoked, the eye cannot say to the hand, I do not need you. And so then, having recognized the problem, having said the approach of the socialists is wrong, having said that it is really mutuality that is the ideal in society, the Holy Father makes a very specific point for which this encyclical is very well remembered, speaking in favor of labor unions. In the last place, so this is near the end of the encyclical, employers and workmen may of themselves affect much in the matter we are treating by means of such associations and organizations as afford opportune aid to those who are in distress and which draw the two classes more closely together. Among these may be enumerated societies for mutual help. And that was becoming quite common. You know, perhaps, that the famous Knights of Columbus, which also would have been beginning about this time, that began as a society of mutual aid because if a man was killed on the job, there was no workman's compensation, there was no social security. So his widow and his children were left destitute. And so the purpose of the Knights of Columbus was originally to take care of the families of the brothers who might be killed. And with the assurance that your family would be taken care of if that happened to you. So the Holy Father would have been entirely in favor of such non-governmental free associations for mutual benefit. Various benevolent foundations established by private persons to provide for the workman and for his widow or his orphans in case of a sudden calamity, in sickness, and in the event of death, and institutions for the welfare of boys and girls, young people, and those more advanced in years. So those are all kinds of societies. But then, paragraph 49, the most important of all are working men's unions, for these virtually include all the rest. History attests what excellent results were brought about by the artificers' guilds of olden times. They were the means of affording not only many advantages to the workmen, but in no small degree of promoting the advancement of art, as numerous monuments remain to bear witness. Such unions should be suited to the requirements of this, our age, an age of wider education, of different habits, and of far more numerous requirements in daily life. It is gratifying to know that there are actually in existence not a few associations of this nature, consisting either of workmen alone or of workmen and employers together. But it were greatly to be desired that they should become more numerous and more efficient. We have spoken of them more than once, yet it will be well to explain here how notably they are needed to show that they exist of their own right and what should be their organization and their mode of action. So this is all very Irenic. This is all very peaceful. But of course, this was a disputed point at the time. And there were, you know, instances of violence, brutality against workers who tried to organize. So this was not these are not just platitudes. This was quite a current question at the time. And as I say, this is probably the element of the encyclical for which it's most remembered, because it is the greatest development. You know, the Holy Father restates things, of course, as we always expect popes to do, restates things that are already well known, well established, well trod ground, but this specific argument in favor of labor unions was what was new. So we've spent a lot of time on the run-up to Rerum Novarum, the situation in which it arose. But it's also very, very interesting to look at the landmark social encyclicals that followed it and to see how the popes in various generations responded to the emerging situation and the developing situation. As I said, you know, with regard to the Holy Trinity, nothing new ever really happens. But with regard to the social teaching of the Church, there is a continual response to history as it unfolds and to the actual concrete situation. So the next encyclical we're going to look at, preparatory to the current encyclical, is entitled Quadragesimo Anno, which means 40 years. It was the work of Pope Pius XI, published in 1931. 40 years, 1931, minus 40, is 1891. That was, of course, Rerum Novarum. So from the beginning, it was clear that Rerum Novarum was a milestone. And so there are subsequent encyclicals that mark time since Rerum Novarum. So 1931. What was happening in 1931 that might be interesting economically? The Great Depression. The crash of the United States stock market in October 1929 ushered in a worldwide depression. As the depression deepened, there was some feeling that capitalism and the liberal democracy, the political system in which it flourished, had failed. And the two alternatives that were presenting themselves in the streets, more in Europe than here in this country, although not absent here either, were fascism and communism. Both appeals to the state, really, to take over the direction of the economy, to take care of things. So that was the context for this encyclical, the worldwide depression and the temptation of fascism and communism. And then, of course, as I mentioned, the ecclesial context is the 40 years since Rerum Novarum. That's where this encyclical gets its title. So the content of this encyclical, working conditions, which were really the issue behind Rerum Novarum and the plight of the new industrial, the working poor in the new industrial age, working conditions were no longer the great issue as they had been 40 years earlier. Pius XI discusses the ethical implications of the social and economic order. He describes the major dangers for human freedom and dignity arising from unrestrained capitalism and totalitarian communism. This will become a very common theme in the Church's social teaching, that unrestrained capitalism has extremely negative results for the human person, that totalitarian communism has even worse consequences for the human person. So Pius XI calls for the reconstruction of the social order based on the principle of solidarity or mutuality, as we've already seen in Pope Leo, and a word that will become very, very important in Catholic social teaching, subsidiarity. Subsidiarity. Does anyone know what subsidiarity is, what that principle is about?
Isn't that when you're trying to solve a problem, the best solution is to do it closest to the source of the problem?
Exactly. That it's best to address any problem, any need, any issue on the lowest level practical, or the most local level practical, or the smallest sphere possible. So some things must be done at the, let's say, the national level, but problems that are essentially local are much, much, much more efficiently addressed at that level. And so you certainly see subsidiarity at work in the life of the church herself, in the church's internal organization. You know, the diocese is divided into parishes, and every parish is essentially the same in its structure. But the staff of each parish, is there a staff? What are the job descriptions? That's organized very differently based on the size of the parish, the finances of the parish, the demographic profile of the parish. Do you have, you know, legions and legions of children and young people, or is it an older downtown parish or whatever? So there's not one way in which every parish is organized which is mandated for every parish structure, because the local conditions will suggest different way to organize the work of each parish. So that's a simple example of subsidiarity. So some passages, some citations from Quadragesimoano of Pius XI. Via media, that's a phrase from someplace else. That's from Cardinal Newman, really. But it's the middle way is what it means. Twin rocks of shipwreck must be carefully avoided. For as one is wrecked upon or comes close to what is known as individualism, by denying or minimizing the social and public character of the right of property, so by rejecting or minimizing the private and individual character of the same right, one inevitably runs into collectivism. So, the Pope is saying, unbridled capitalism and communism, those are sort of economic systems, but a sort of spirit underlying each of those would be individualism, extreme individualism, a sort of individualism that is in alienation almost from other persons on one side, versus a collectivism on the other side, that the individual counts for nothing and is only interesting as a part of the whole. It was very interesting. You know, we in Catholic moral teaching with regard to life issues also, we very, very frequently use the word person. One of the reasons for that is that the word person is meant to contain in itself both considerations there, or to take account of these two competing perspectives. A person is a singular human being, so the value of the person is affirmed as against looking at the person only as a member of the class and the interests of the class must be taken care of, even if it means killing many people within that class. You can sacrifice, you know, all kinds of people for the sake of the ideology. So person affirms the importance, the dignity, the centrality of each one, but person does not contain the little wall that is suggested by individual. Individual suggests, you know, this one is all alone. Person is meant to contain within itself relationship. The person is a person, not just because of the human nature contained in this particular one, but person, one is a person by being in communion, in communication, in relationship with others. So that's one of the reasons why person is so important in Catholic moral thought and used so often, because the use of the word individual, we're less, I mean, there's nothing wrong with using that word, but the word individual suggests that my interests, my rights are against everyone else's. You know, you must not constrain me in exercising my rights. Person is one who is in communication, in relationship with others. So the person certainly has rights, but it's not a question of vindicating rights always against another. That's the intention, anyway, of that word. In the same subject, another passage from the Holy Father, the right ordering of economic life cannot be left to a free competition of forces. For from this source, as from a poisoned spring, have originated and spread all the errors of individualist economic teaching. It held that economic life must be considered and treated as altogether free and independent of public authority, because in the market, that is, in the free struggle of competitors, it would have a principle of self-direction, which governs it much more perfectly than would the intervention of any created intellect. But free competition, while justified and certainly useful, provided it is kept within certain limits, clearly cannot direct economic life. So there was the sense that this lack of any fetters on economic, not only competition, but also speculation, had led to the stock market crash and the depression. The concentration of power and might, the characteristic mark of contemporary economic life, is the fruit that the unlimited freedom of struggle among competitors has of its own nature produced, and which lets only the strongest survive. And this is often the same as saying, those who fight the most violently, those who give the least heed to their conscience. So that's a problem of unbridled competition, that those who are most unscrupulous can, in fact, seem to come out ahead or come out ahead on this in this short run. Then the Pius XI on mutuality. The riches that the economic social developments constantly increase ought to be so distributed among individual persons and classes that the common good of all society will be kept inviolate. For man's productive efforts cannot yield its fruits unless a truly social and organic body exists. That's just what Leo XIII said, an organic body that's mutually beneficial. Unless a social and juridical order watches over the exercise of work, unless the various occupations, being interdependent, cooperate with and mutually complete one another, and what is still more important, unless mind, material things, and work combine and form, as it were, a single whole. So it's not just economy, but also all the aspects of the human person. And then a description of subsidiarity. Just as it is gravely wrong to take from individuals what they can accomplish by their own initiative and industry and give it to the community, so also it is an injustice and at the same time a grave evil and disturbance of right order to assign to a greater and higher association what lesser and subordinate organizations can do. For every social activity ought of its very nature to furnish help to the members of the body social and never destroy and absorb them. So that's one statement of that principle of subsidiarity, that you should not assign to greater and higher levels of association what can be done at the more localized level. So, the Great Depression, problems of the capitalist system are exposed, and that provides the occasion for Pius XI to write the new encyclical on the 40th anniversary of Rerum Novarum. The next, we come close to ourselves in time. 1967, Pope Paul VI publishes an encyclical called Populorum Progressio, The Progress of Peoples. The Progress of Peoples. What is the context for this encyclical in 1967? The questions of capital and labor had pretty well been resolved, at least in the West. The crisis of the Depression was behind us. Of course, when World War II began, everybody had a job. But now there's a new situation. The post-war era saw former colonial possessions gaining their independence. Britain had promised independence to the people of India. So in 1947, a couple of years after the war, India and Pakistan gained their independence from the British Empire. French Indochina from 1949 to 1954. Nigeria, former British colony in 1960. Algeria, very bitter struggle with the French, finally ended with Algerian independence in 1962. The nations of British East Africa from about 1962 to 1965. By 1967, about the only European colonies left in the world were the Portuguese colonies in Africa and islands scattered around the world. All the other nations of the world that had been the colonies of Britain, France, Spain, Germany, Holland, they were all independent. Populorum Progressio was written in the wake of decolonization to address the question of the development of the Third World, the development of these newly independent nations. There was also an ecclesiastical context for Populorum Progressio. The Second Vatican Council had just concluded. You know, the Second Vatican Council was held in four autumn sessions from 1962 until 1965. So in December 1965, the council ended. This is a couple years later. The council had placed new emphasis on the church's concern not just with the eternal salvation of all people, but with their joys and struggles in the world. Now, of course, from what we've seen already this morning, this is not entirely new. It's not that the church was only thinking about heaven for the first 1965 years. There was the social teaching of the church from the very beginning. But undeniably, there was a new emphasis on this in the documents of the Second Vatican Council. The Pastoral Constitution on the Church in the Modern World was a document with the Latin title Gaudium et Spes, which you probably recognize. Gaudium means joy in Latin, and spes means hope. And so the opening words of that Pastoral Constitution on the church in the modern world were the joys and the hopes, the griefs and the anxieties of the men of this age, especially those who are poor or in any way afflicted. These are the joys and hopes, the griefs and anxieties of the followers of Christ. Indeed, nothing genuinely human fails to raise an echo in their hearts. So there was a desire for a sort of turn to the world at the time of the Second Vatican Council, to be concerned not only with the interior operation of the church and the work of the church for the salvation of souls, but a desire for the light of the gospel to be more clearly brought to all of the aspects of human life and the human condition. There was, of course, a reciprocal or an accompanying understanding that the world had something to offer to the church in terms of the understanding of what was happening in the world. That, disciplined, the secular disciplines that could tell us something about human psychology, human society, etc. The church could learn from these studies, if they were, rightly and truthfully, accurately done. The church could learn from these things how to analyze the human situation so as to let the light of the gospel shine on them more clearly. The unfortunate result that sometimes took place was that was misunderstood to suggest that the insights of the human sciences were now more interesting than the truth of the gospel, that these somehow supplant and correct the truth of the gospel. So that, I don't think Pope John the 23rd exactly would have seen it that way. But that was the dynamic at that time. There was a turn to the world, and so Pope Paul VI says, wow, we have all these newly independent countries that are not in ideal condition, the conditions of life in these countries calls out for our compassion, and the church wants to say something that will be helpful and constructive in all these situations. So, the content of this encyclical of Paul VI, Populorum Progressio, holds that the economy of the world should serve mankind and not just the few. It touches a variety of principles that have already become traditional in Catholic social teaching that we have talked about already. The right to a just wage, the right to security of employment, the right to fair and reasonable working conditions, the right to join a union, and the universal destination of resources. That's what Thomas Aquinas was talking about when saying that for the use, the goods of the world have been given by God to the whole human race. That's called the universal destination of goods. So a couple of citations from Populorum Progressio. Today, the principal fact that we must all recognize is that the social question has become worldwide. Of course, Pope Leo XIII was thinking about all of Europe, North America, especially when he wrote Rerum Novarum. But the questions that touched all industrialized societies were not questions that exactly connected them all to each other. It was the same question, but it was the question that found expression locally. By 1967, the social question has become a question that affects the relationship among nations, and also affects every nation. The Rerum Novarum, Pope Leo XIII wasn't thinking so much of the Belgian Congo when he maybe there wasn't even a Belgian Congo yet at that point. I don't remember those dates. But he wasn't thinking about that so much when he wrote Rerum Novarum. He was thinking of Manchester and Liverpool and New York and Philadelphia, you know? So, but in 1967, the question is worldwide, it's global. In the present day, however, individual and group efforts within these countries is no longer enough. The world situation requires the concerted effort of everyone, a thorough examination of every facet of the problem, social, economic, cultural, and spiritual. That will become more and more clear and significant. Sharing the noblest aspirations of men and suffering when she sees these aspirations not satisfied. She wishes to help them attain their full realization. She also offers man her distinctive contribution. That's, she is the church, of course. A global perspective on man and human realities. Global in two senses. Both taking care for the whole world and thinking of the whole human person. So global in more than one way. Integral development. That's another phrase that will become very important and is important in the current encyclical. Authentic human development concerns the whole of the person in every single dimension. That is absolutely central in the current encyclical that we're supposed to be talking about, and we will be shortly. The development is not just a matter of economics, gross national product, gross domestic product, average per capita income, or anything like that. Authentic human development must take account of the human person. The human person is not just a producer and consumer. The human person has many dimensions which must be given their due if you're really thinking about authentic development. The developing nations must choose wisely from among the things that are offered to them. They must test and reject false values that would tarnish a truly human way of life. It's a very current issue. While accepting noble and useful values in order to develop them in their own distinctive way, along with their own indigenous heritage. The ultimate good is a full-bodied humanism. And does this not mean the fulfillment of the whole man and of every man? A narrow humanism, closed in on itself and not open to the values of the Spirit and to God, who is their source, could achieve apparent success. For man can set about organizing terrestrial realities without God. But, closed off from God, they will end up being directed against man. A humanism closed off from other realities becomes inhuman. Those are quite prophetic words. You know, the word humanism has a little bit of a bad odor at the moment because it's often used to mean atheism, atheistic humanism. Humanism means is the human being is the master of all, is the standard of all, is the arbiter of what's right and true and good, that the human is exalted at the expense of the divine, who is no longer in the picture. So humanism means practically atheism in the way it's often used today. But the popes use that word very enthusiastically, not to refer to a humanism asserted against God, but to represent a perspective that says, really, the whole creation is for the human person. You know, God did not create the world for himself. He created the world for us. But that the authentic Christian humanism takes into account the whole person. It does not reduce the person to a producer or a consumer or a foot soldier or a pawn in the for some ideology, some political ideology or something like that. Christian humanism means to speak to the whole of the human person, to do what is good for the human person in the totality of who we are. And as I say, the Pope Paul is quite prophetic in saying that the other kind of humanism, atheistic humanism without God, becomes inhuman very quickly, is turned against the human person. It's time for another break. I feel that, and I think you do too. And I think we're actually going to not say so much about these two encyclicals of Pope John Paul. It's very interesting, of course. Again, the historical angle, the first of these, Solicitudo Rei Socialis, care for the social reality, care for the social thing. In 1987, though I think probably everyone in this room still, all of these times live in our memory with a great deal of vividness, that, the Pope John Paul was elected in 1978, 1979. He went to Poland for the first time, and there were just masses and masses of people coming out to see the Holy Father. And this was the occasion, the birth of the independent trade union Solidarity, which led to the ultimately, more or less, with some nuances, to the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Soviet bloc. So these two encyclicals are positioned just prior to the fall of the Berlin Wall. The Pope speaks about solidarity, and then just after the fall of the Soviet Union, or during almost the fall of the Soviet Union, where the Holy Father talks about what's the way forward now. The competition between the East and West looks like it's been resolved, but what is the authentic way forward? So these are very interesting historical moments. Maybe, I can't resist. We'll just say a quick word about them after we come back, and then we'll go on to the present encyclical. A home stretch here. We have until noon, I think, right? Straight up? All right. So, I talked already about the context for these two encyclicals of the Holy Father. The ideas in the encyclicals are quite important for the current encyclical, and so I think we better just say a word about them. And maybe I'll just try to read them. So, on the issue of development, which, of course, was also the issue of Populorum Progressio of Paul VI. Next to the underdevelopment of the many, there is a superdevelopment of the few. Superdevelopment leads to a throwaway society and to enormous waste. So not a country where industrial production has not yet come, but one where, well, we can produce lots of things, so we have to throw stuff away, or there's nobody to buy the new stuff. So that's super development. Excessive access to all kinds of things, sometimes called consumerism, enslaves people and does not make them happy. The more one possesses, the more one wants, while the deeper human hopes remain unsatisfied and even stifled. Having more things does not necessarily mean being more or being better. Having only helps us when it contributes to a more complete being. And that, of course, is precisely the point of Pope Paul, who maybe Pope Paul didn't quite put as sharp a point on it, but when Pope Paul talked about human development must affect the whole person in every single dimension, not just having more stuff. Pope John Paul again, to commit oneself to the development of the whole person and every human being is an obligation not only for the individual, but also for societies and nations, and especially for the Catholic community and other Christian churches. And then on the famous word solidarity. Solidarity helps us to see the other, whether a person, a particular person who's not myself, people, not my people, but your people, another people, or a nation, not just as some kind of instrument with a work capacity and physical strength to be exploited at low cost and then discarded when no longer useful, but as our neighbor, of course, very biblical, a helper, to be made a sharer on a par with ourselves in the banquet of life to which all are equally invited by God. This is sometimes something I mention to people in confession too. You know that sometimes we think about our sins, sometimes there are other persons involved in our sins, and there's always the temptation to see them as sort of, you know, minor cast members in the story of my life, you know? But that's not right, you know? Their importance is not being minor players in the all-important story of my life. They are persons created by God, loved by God, called by God to be with Him. They have the same dignity and value as myself. So they're not just significant in the effect that they happen to have on me, or vice versa. Then centesimus annus, which means the 100th year, published in 1991. What was 100 years from 1991? 1891, the day of days, the year of years for Catholic social teaching. And here, of course, as I say, the Soviet bloc was falling apart. And this, what the Pope says about the Cold War, he doesn't use that phrase, of course. Can it perhaps be said that after the failure of communism, capitalism is the victorious social system, and that capitalism should be the goal of the countries now making efforts to rebuild their economy and society? The answer is obviously complex. If by capitalism is meant an economic system which recognizes the fundamental and positive role of business, the market, private property, and the resulting responsibility for the means of production, as well as free human creativity in the economic sector, then the answer is certainly in the affirmative. All of those things have been clearly shown to be helpful to the human person and human society. But if by capitalism is meant a system in which freedom in the economic sector is not circumscribed within a strong juridical framework which places it at the service of human freedom in its totality and sees it as a particular aspect of that freedom, the core of which is ethical and religious, then the reply is certainly negative. So, if all of those things that make an economy prosperous are exalted to the exclusion of the ethical and the religious, the care for the richness of human life in relationship with others, the family, for one notable example, then that's not helpful to the human race, the human person. Then authentic humanism. Human persons are willed by God. They're imprinted with God's image. Their dignity does not come from the work they do, but from the persons they are. Now, there is a dignity of work. That is an extremely traditional Catholic principle. There's a dignity in human work. We are co-creators with God. We take the good things that God has given us and make them more valuable than they were by the addition of our ingenuity and our physical skill. So there is a great dignity in human work, but it is not work that gives the human person his or her dignity. That would be different. That would be to say you're only important to the extent that you can produce. Yet alienation is still a reality in Western societies because of consumerism that does not help one appreciate one's authentic personhood, and because of work, which shows interest only in profit, and none in the workers, considering them to be mere means. And development, after the fall of real socialism, Capitalism is not the only economic alternative left. Individuals and nations need the basic things that enable them to share in development. The principle that debts should be paid remains, but this should not be asked for at the cost of the hunger and despair of entire peoples. That's going to be very important in the context for the new encyclical. So that, with regard to the heritage of Catholic social teaching, there are many important documents that we have not looked at. Most of those are encyclicals listed there. A couple of them are letters of other kinds. But if you look at a compendium of Catholic social teaching, and even at the current encyclical, you'll find all those documents cited as touching on or presenting Catholic social teaching. All right, so that brings us to the current encyclical, Caritas in Veritate, Charity, Love in Truth. So first, a word about the context of this encyclical. So the new encyclical is situated within the social magisterium, or that is to say, the teaching of the church about social issues. And it's very interesting. Let's see what comes to your mind in this 12th paragraph from Caritas in Veritate. Much of the beginning, the first chapter of the new encyclical is a review of the encyclical Populorum Progressio of Paul VI. And the Pope Benedict makes the point that Populorum Progressio was related to the teaching of the Second Vatican Council, as I've described it, you know, the council's interest in the condition of the person in the modern world. But then listen to what Pope says in paragraph 12 and see what this, what other famous theme this reminds you of. The link between Populorum Progressio and the Second Vatican Council does not mean that Paul VI's social magisterium marked a break with that of previous popes, because the council constitutes a deeper exploration of this magisterium within the continuity of the church's life. It is not a case of two typologies of social doctrine, one preconciliar before the council, and one post-conciliar after the council, differing from one another. On the contrary, there is a single teaching, consistent and at the same time ever new. It is one thing to draw attention to the particular characteristics of one encyclical or another, or the teaching of one pope or another. You can certainly do that. You can look at a particular encyclical and highlight its particular characteristics for its own time. But quite another to lose sight of the coherence of the overall doctrinal corpus. Coherence does not mean a closed system. It's not as if every pope is only repeating what previous popes have said. On the contrary, it means dynamic faithfulness to a light received. The church's social doctrine illuminates with an unchanging light the new problems that are constantly emerging. So this whole morning sort of is a illustration of that point. This safeguards the permanent and historical character of the doctrinal patrimony, the treasure we've received, which, with its specific characteristics, is part and parcel of the church's ever-living tradition. So, look at paragraph 12. What famous phrases that we hear bandied about is at stake there in that paragraph from Pope Benedict? The hermeneutic of continuity and discontinuity. That's a frequent theme of Bishop Morlino, that there was not one Catholic faith before 1962 and another Catholic faith after 1965. There's one faith. And so the Pope makes that point specifically with regard to the social teaching of the church, that there was a new perspective of Pope Paul VI, but is not a different teaching. It is the application of the ancient teaching of the church to the contemporary situation, which is very, very Catholic, of course. And so the Pope refers to an ever-living tradition. So it occurred to me as I was thinking about that, the two things that that's not. I don't know if you've noticed, maybe, I hope this isn't uncharitable, but I don't know if you've noticed that the ad campaign of the United Church of Christ, Protestant denomination, that uses the phrase, God is still speaking. See it on bumper stickers once in a while? So the intention of that seems to be that they are listening to God who is still speaking and now saying things entirely contrary to what he used to say, especially on certain moral issues. So that is a lack of respect for the continuity of tradition. God does not say now what is in contradiction to what he said 100 or 1,000 years ago. On the other side of the spectrum, there's a group, it's quite small, so perhaps you've never heard of it, but it's a Catholic group called the American Society for the Defense of Tradition, Family, and Property. And it's part of a larger worldwide group. But their position is that the only real Catholic is a monarchist, if I take them correctly. That, the whole the system of government intended by God is really monarchy. And that unless we get rid of liberal democracies, we can't really be Catholic. So that does not respect, that approach does not respect the fact that there is a living tradition. So we don't want to fall off the side of the table at the United Church of Christ, nor with the tradition, family, and property. But we want to be with Pope Benedict XVI saying that the church has an ever-living tradition, a real tradition in real continuity, but also living. The current encyclical is very clearly situated within the tradition of Catholic social teaching. The first chapter, as I mentioned, is entitled The Message of Populorum Progressio. And in fact, that chapter and the whole encyclical cite not only that document, but all the documents that we've looked at this morning and many others very frequently. So that's the ecclesiastical context of this encyclical that is within the tradition of the church. But why this new social encyclical now? The encyclical, as I mentioned at the very first, was published in 2009. When we think of 2009, we think, oh yeah, social encyclical in 2009. That was a very dramatic year. That was when the housing bubble burst, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were tumbling down, followed by a plunge in the stock market, a credit crisis, major recession, and a very weak dollar. It will perhaps surprise you to learn that this encyclical is not about any of those things. And in fact, you would never know that any of that happened from reading this encyclical. That's what I expected when it came out. I thought, oh, he's going to condemn derivatives or something in the encyclical. No, there's absolutely nothing like that. What's really interesting to the Pope, maybe that's overstating it, but one thing that is in the Pope's mind when he wrote this encyclical was the debt crisis of the Third World. And that's why I threw that last line from Pope John Paul II, that, we don't think about this much because this isn't our problem, in a sense, But the Third World has massive debt to the First World, and much of the money that was borrowed was just stolen by corrupt government officials. And so the people of these nations burden under the need to repay this debt with little prospect of any benefit whatsoever. So it's much more a global difficulty, the global south, as it's sometimes called, the third world, as we used to say, that is much more in the Pope's mind than the hiccup, or maybe it's more than that, whatever it is, in our own system. I had a Nigerian priest with me once helping at the parish, and we had an election, a presidential election going on just then, and so I said to this priest, was describing the candidates, and I said about the one particular candidate, we don't really think that he's quite honest. And the Nigerian priest laughed. Oh, ho, 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 ho. He said, in my country, when someone runs for office, we presume it is so that he can steal. The big man steals the most. Those under him steal a little less. So it's funny, but it's not funny if you live in that country. And so that's the debt crisis of the third world. So, then to get to the encyclical. First of all, the title. Only two major words in the title: caritas, charity, and veritas, truth, in veritate, in truth. So first, caritas. This word means charity or truth. It is not the word justice. One might expect that an encyclical about social issues would have in its title the word justice. As we have seen, a demand for justice has been an important part of social teaching since Old Testament times. It's important for the children of Israel, is an important notion in Catholic social teaching from the beginning. In fact, Pope Benedict mentions the necessity of justice in many places in the present encyclical. He insists on it near the beginning of the encyclical. Quotation here. First of all, justice. Ubi societas, ibi ius. Where there is society, there is justice. Or as the Pope translates it, every society draws upon its own system of justice. Charity, caritas, goes beyond justice. Because to love is to give, to offer what is mine to the other. But it never lacks justice, which prompts us to give the other what is his, what is due to him by reason of his being or his acting. I cannot give what is mine to the other without first giving him what pertains to him in justice. So the Pope is not does not ignore the demands of justice, does not overlook the necessity of justice. The Pope says that justice is necessary in every phase of economic activity. That's in paragraph 37. And that specific injustices must always be redressed. That's in paragraph 20. So Pope Benedict is entirely in favor of justice. But he does not use it in the title of this encyclical. Why not? Because not all poverty is the result of injustice. The wealth of Switzerland does not cause Somalia to be poor. There can be inequities in the relationships between countries, and Pope says those must be addressed. But poverty is not necessarily caused by injustice, and so justice is not the answer to the problem of underdevelopment. It's not the complete answer. Although all injustices need to be redressed. Also, in the late, in the 70s and into the 80s, social justice was a very popular theme in the life of the church. But this phrase was often used in a way that had overtones of struggle. This reached its ultimate expression in liberation theology, which 20 or 30 years ago was a very, very hot topic. I think less so today. But liberation theology, you know, pled for the liberation of people who live in poverty, in bad social conditions, people who are suffering, especially in the third world. It held that they must be liberated. Jesus came for liberation. Those who suffer under unjust structures, those who are oppressed, must be liberated. And this is so central a concern that even violence is tolerated. Sometimes even violence is advocated in the struggle against the oppressors. So, you know, you had the Sandinistas in Nicaragua with a revolution against the government, and a priest or two who were in the cabinet, you know, carrying their AK-47s along with the other rebels. And you may remember a famous picture of one of those priests. He genuflected to kiss Pope John Paul's ring when the Pope visited Nicaragua, and the Pope very, very visibly wagged his finger at this priest to tell him, "You are not doing what a priest should be doing." So that was liberation theology. And that was sort of the ultimate expression of this focus on social justice. So justice, fantastically important and absolutely necessary, virtue, and part of Catholic social teaching. But it's not the answer to every form of poverty, because not all poverty is caused by injustice, and it carries a little baggage from its recent history. Ever since he confronted communist ideology in 1891, Leo XIII was sensitive to the danger of conflict and struggle and armed revolution. And, you know, even Pope Leo XIII at the very beginning was careful to talk about the necessity of cooperation between owners and workers. When Pope John Paul II adopted the word solidarity, he is thinking not only of solidarity within the union. Of course, solidarity is a very famous union word. You know, there's a song and everything that they sing in strikes. Pope John Paul II, he was thinking about that, of course, the solidarity of the men in the Gdansk shipyards, but also solidarity of all persons within the Polish society, which to Pope John Paul II was absolutely clear that this was accomplished by the faith. That was absolutely evident, that all the Polish people understood one another as brothers and sisters by virtue of a deep cultural, religious, historical connection that they all had with each other. So it's, solidarity is not just solidarity of the union against the communist government. It was the solidarity of the whole culture, which is the fruit of the faith. When Benedict XVI wants to write about social questions, he does not use the word justice in the title, but caritas, love, or charity. So for Christians, of course, is always the perspective of charity that is more primary. We saw that in the words of the Lord in the Gospels. So charity and development, caritas. Still thinking about that word in the title. In the opening sentence of the encyclical, Benedict XVI says that charity, now listen to this, charity is the driving force behind all development. Development, okay, we're talking about especially the underdeveloped world, being able to live a more humane and rich and fruitful life. Charity, the Pope says, is the driving force behind all development. That's the very first sentence of the encyclical. Charity and truth, which is why this, where this sickle gets its name, to which Jesus Christ bore witness by his earthly life and especially by his death and resurrection, is the principal driving force behind the authentic development of every person and of all humanity. Charity is the driving force behind development. The reason I highlight that is, unless you had listened to the first 2.5 hours of this talk, you would say, no, that does not sound right. Charity is the driving force behind development? Charity, we usually think, has something to do with handouts, you know, giving a food voucher or a gas voucher or something to someone who is in need. Development has to do with the system working. They almost sound like opposite approaches to world poverty. Charity means giving handouts. Development means making the system work. But that would be a false conclusion to think that those are opposites. Charity has a much more primary and important meaning than a charitable gift, a handout, if you will. Charity is love which desires the good of the other. And this is precisely what drives all the noblest hopes and plans for development. As it was suggested in those words of Pope John Paul earlier, that, you know, to see the other as neighbor, to have a concern that that other share in the richness of life that, that you yourself enjoy. That's what motivates development. Now, there are other motivations for development too. You know, well, let's build factories there because we can get people to work more cheaply. Or let's build factories there so that they have some income so that they can also be consumers and they can buy our manufactured goods. Those are not evil in themselves, those motivations. But authentic development is motivated by charity, a concern for the totality of the good of human persons, a desire that they share in the fullness of the good that we have a share in. Charity, caritas, another aspect of caritas, is that it is integral. This love must be a concern for persons in their totality. I guess that's just what we've been saying. It's this that's the engine of all authentic, integral development. And here we make reference to the English title of this encyclical. The Latin title is Caritas in Veritate, Love in Truth. As I mentioned earlier, typically Roman documents have another title in the vernacular languages, which gives a clear idea of what's in them. And so the English title of this encyclical, or equivalents in other modern languages, is On Integral Human Development in Charity and Truth. So the charity in truth that the Pope is talking about, this is aimed at integral human development, the development of the whole person in all the goods that pertain to the human person. Although the economic woes of the Third World and others occasion this encyclical as the debt crisis, as I said, which is very prominent, Pope Benedict's concern is clearly not limited to economic development, talking about that. And finally, caritas, last aspect of this word in the title, caritas is inclusive. Christian charity is not exclusive. It is inclusive in desiring the good of the whole person, that's what we've said, integral, but also in desiring the good of all persons. We know this as Christians. We can't say, my great charity for this person or my makes me hate that other person. My great charity for the poor makes me hate the oppressors. No. Charity, if charity is real charity, it does not lead to hating anyone. Caritas is inclusive. It does not despise the good of anyone. It does not hate anyone. And of course, this is what allows the Catholic social teaching to avoid the pitfall of socialism and communism in seeing all as opposition and strife. And also the central notion in Catholic social ethics of the common good. We haven't talked too much about that, but that also is an expression of the inclusiveness of charity. That I'm not just interested in the good of some, I'm interested in the common good, the good of all. All right, the second important word in this title is veritas, which means truth. It becomes ablative when it's after preposition in, so in veritate. But the nominative is veritas. So the importance of truth is the first point. The Pope says, charity, love, cannot be separated from truth. And this is very classic, Benedict XVI. And so this bears careful reading, I think. The Pope, here's a little change in encyclicals. Leo XIII would always refer to himself as we, the majestic plural. Now the popes, when they're encyclicals, they're just I. They're just singular. So the Pope says of himself, I am aware of the ways in which charity has been and continues to be misconstrued and emptied of meaning. People misunderstand what love is. With the consequent risk of being misinterpreted, detached from ethical living, and in any event, undervalued. In the social, juridical, cultural, political, and economic fields, the contexts, in other words, that are most exposed to this danger, it is easily dismissed as irrelevant for interpreting and giving direction to moral responsibility. So, charity has been emptied of objective meaning, and when that happens, it's dismissed as irrelevant to making practical decisions in the world of things. Hence, the need to link charity with truth, not only in the sequence pointed out by St. Paul, of veritas in caritate, that's a phrase from the letter to the Ephesians, truth in charity, but also in the inverse and complementary sequence, titled this encyclical, of caritas in veritate. Truth needs to be sought, found, and expressed within the economy of charity, but charity in its turn needs to be understood, confirmed, and practiced in the light of truth. In this way, not only do we do a service of charity enlightened by truth, but we also help give credibility to truth, demonstrating its persuasive and authenticating power in the practical setting of social living. This is a matter of no small account today in a social and cultural context which relativizes truth, often paying little heed to it and showing increasing reluctance to acknowledge its existence. So he's saying that by practicing charity and truth, we help people see the value of truth, because most people can see the value of charity or love. But so one consequence when charity is separated from truth, when there's no objective content to love, is that it seems to be irrelevant to practical questions. You can say, well, you can't talk about love in talking about how this should be organized, because who knows what that is? You know, that different people have a different idea of what that means, so it's irrelevant to any practical discussion of how things should be organized. So that's danger one. Also, without truth, charity degenerates into sentimentality. Love becomes an empty shell to be filled in an arbitrary way. In a culture without truth, this is the fatal risk facing love. It falls prey to contingent, subjective emotions and opinions. The word love is abused and distorted to the point where it comes to mean the opposite. If we want to have, if we want to serve the true good of the human person and of all persons, we must have a sound idea of what the human person is. If we don't have a sound idea of what the human person is, we cannot have a sound understanding of what it really means to love the human person, to promote the human person's good. And in fact, we can do the opposite. So, this is very clear if you just put it in a little concrete example. What's the human person? What's the human person for? What is our life about? If you believed that the human person is essentially a seeker of pleasure, that human life is about having as much pleasure and as little pain as possible, then what does it mean to serve the human good? What would it mean to love is to serve the good of the other person. So if what you understand a human person to be is a consumer of pleasure, an avoider of pain, then the best thing that you could do to the human person, the loving thing to do for the human person, would be to provide as many consumer goods and pleasures as possible, and then euthanasia at the end. When you couldn't enjoy those things very well anymore, and there was pain in the prospect, then the loving thing would be euthanasia. So, misunderstanding what the human person is, or a lack of a truth about that, leads to a misunderstanding of what love means in that context. So love has to be joined to truth. Otherwise you say, well, yes, I feel warm and fuzzy about everybody and I want to help everybody. Well, that's lovely. But if you don't know what is the human good, then you don't know whether you're helping them or hurting them. You don't know whether what you're trying to do with goodwill perhaps is really counterproductive. The second point the Pope makes about truth, that's my extraction of a second point. He doesn't say this is his second point. Truth allows charity to have a public and shared existence. That really is what we've already seen a little bit in that first point above. Through this close link with truth, charity can be recognized as an authentic expression of humanity and as an element of fundamental importance in human relations, including those of a public nature. Only in truth does charity shine forth. Only in truth can charity be authentically lived. Truth is the light that gives meaning and value to charity. Truth frees charity from the constraints of an emotionalism that deprives it of a relational and social content, and of a fideism that deprives it of human and universal breathing space. This phrase here, a public nature, that it's only when there is a public discussion and a certain consensus, maybe not universal consensus, but a certain public consensus about what truth is, that charity can have a public life. Because then there is agreement about what charity means, about what serves the human good. And without that understanding, without the truth about what the human person is, charity has no relational or social content. You do what, on your better days, you do what you think is loving and helpful for others. But you can't talk about that to anyone else because that person might have a completely different idea of what the human person is and what is good for the human person. So what you're doing with the intention of charity does not make sense to the other person because you're serving some good that is not agreed upon. So it's truth that allows charity to be shared, for there to be a public aspect, a relational aspect of it. Because it is filled with truth, charity can be understood in the abundance of its values. It can be shared and communicated. And here's a lovely little linguistic thing. I'm sure the Pope was very happy when he came up with this. Truth, in fact, is logos. Logos is a Greek word. It means word, but it also has the sense of truth in some way. The word, you know, truth is communicated in word. So truth, in fact, is logos. Oh, logos also sort of means reason sometimes. Truth, in fact, is logos, which creates dialogos. Dia means through in Greek, but dialogos, you know, we recognize the word dialogue. So it's truth, logos, that creates dialogue. You cannot talk with someone profitably unless you have a shared notion of what is true. You cannot talk to someone profitably, rationally, you cannot make progress in a real dialogue, a real conversation, unless there's some mutual understanding of what the real goal is, of what the real ideal is. Logos creates dialogos, and hence communication and communion. Otherwise, you can shout at each other, but you cannot really have a dialogue unless there's a shared understanding of what's really good and what the you can agree what the goal really is. And the rest of that paragraph is very nice, but it's more or less saying the same thing. And it's just a couple of minutes until noon. So I think we must hold in abeyance the, we've talked about why the truth about the human person is important. Now the last point in this first part is, what is the truth about the human person? So the last of these notes identify Pope Benedict says are some of the essential truths about the human person that must direct development, and that we have to keep in mind as we try to express the love that wants to share good things with others and their ability to have and to enjoy the things of life in this world. So next time we will talk about those couple of aspects of the truth about the human person. And then we'll go into the rest of the encyclical, the Pope's identification of the three forces or aspects of life that must be held together for authentic development, and then some of the particular problems that face the world in our time with respect to authentic, integral human development, and maybe a few words about some encouraging things that we can see happen. So that's the plan for next time. Yes?
Yeah. I don't understand this phrase. It's under your second point, under the importance of truth.
Okay.
And a fideism.
Fideism, okay.
That phrase.
Okay, that comes from the Latin word fides, which means faith. And fideism is saying, well, you have to believe this because it's what the Bible says. That would be an example of fideism. To say, it's my faith that directs my understanding of what the good is, but I know that because I believe what God has said, but unless you have that same faith that I do, you and I really can't work together on this. So, of course, Catholics do believe the revealed faith. But the Catholic faith is distinguished from fideism by the fact that we say what God has told us comports very well with what we know by observation about human life and the world in which we live. God has told us that the relations, human relations should be in this way, and gosh, What do you know? We notice that if there's deviation from this, there are really horrible consequences that follow. So although we do believe the faith based on revelation and making the ascent of faith, it's not fideism because it does not require the suspension of our ability to observe and understand. On the contrary, we in our Catholic faith, we have this extreme conviction that all truth comes from God. And what we can know by human means is not in contradiction to what the faith teaches us. So fideism would say, well, this is what God says, and that's what I know. But if, I mean, that's, there's something virtuous about that, but that doesn't allow communication with anyone else who isn't a Mormon, you know? Yes?
Bring you 2000, the Pope asked the prosperous countries to forgive the debt of the third world countries. Did that ever happen?
You know, I think there was some response to that.
I wonder, I never heard about any response. I remember that I was thrown out there, but I didn't think anything happened.
It certainly did not happen globally and entirely. The request, the Pope John Paul with the Jubilee year of 2000, of the second millennium, one of the traditions in the Jubilee year was the forgiveness of debts in Israel, ancient Israel. So Pope John Paul proposed that the first world countries forgive the debt of the third world countries in the Jubilee year. And I think there was some positive action as a result of that, but not certainly not a blanket. All right. Well, it's noon. We've done our duty. So see you in 3 weeks. Huh? Thank you.